Discussions about homelessness and how to get people into permanent shelter invariably turn to subsections of the homeless population. One in particular draws attention from local officials, as it did from the city councils in several parts of the region in the last few years. Eugene and Ashland called them travelers. Other towns call them other names. To untrained eyes, they look like people who choose to live on the streets. Our guest this hour got to know a few of them. Vivian Ho is the author of Those Who Wander, America's Lost Street Kids. The central events in the book are two murders in and near San Francisco earlier this decade. Let's get to know the events and the writer. Vivian Ho is a journalist with a long list of credits, including work published in the San Francisco Chronicle, the Boston Globe, and the Guardian. Vivian, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
So the trigger for the book came while you were at the Chronicle on the crime beat. What happened?
I actually was just starting out my career as a journalist, and I was assigned a murder case. And it came to me as just a regular murder, and then 2 days after, there was another murder, and it became very clear early on that these two murders were connected. What happened was that in October 2015, Audrey Carey, a 23-year-old Canadian backpacker, was found fatally shot in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. 2 days later, Steve Carter was found shot a couple of miles north in Marin County on a hiking trail. It came out that these two individuals were shot and killed by three drifters, three young street kids that I profile in the book. And it ignited a big media firestorm in the Bay Area, for sure.
Well, so the media firestorm is one thing, and of course it becomes the search for justice. But beyond that, was there much interest from the public or the editors in the circumstances of the people who were accused of committing the crimes?
It became a very understandable fear that came out with the public. We fear what we don't understand, and what happened immediately was that the mugshots of these three individuals, they were arrested in Portland, Oregon. The mugshots of these individuals were splashed on every news channel, every front page, every news website, and everybody saw these faces, and they started seeing the kids that we see on the street corners every day. We saw the kids that we passed walking to work. We see the kids panhandling and asking for change, busking on the street corners. And we kept wondering, could the next person be us? Could it be us that was killed instead of these two individuals?
There's a impactful, well, a lot of impactful things in the book, but at the sentencing, one victim's wife, it was Steve Carter's wife, said at the sentencing to the three, "You're not human beings." They are, obviously. And who are they?
The three drifters that are at the center of this, it's Martin Hayes Lampley, Lila Alligood, and Sean Angold. The main ringleader was Hayes Lampley, and I talked to him in depth. What I learned from diving into the story and from my time covering this case was that the situation was much more complicated than we originally thought. It's not so much an easy open and shut murder case. There were circumstances that led to the shootings, that led to what brought those kids to those situations, that led them to believe that they wanted to rob and shoot those two individuals in the park and on the hiking trail that day. And those circumstances were, unfortunately, the circumstances that are facing hundreds of thousands of kids who are wandering our streets every day.
So the idea of them being homeless by choice, you say in the book, is inaccurate and, in fact, damaging. So why did you find the likes of Hayes and Sean and Lila out on the streets?
It's, you know, homeless by choice is a hard situation because, you know, I think it's easy for us to look at this subset of homelessness, and we look at these kids, we look at them, and we think, look, here are these seemingly able-bodied young individuals. You could probably get a job. You could walk into a store, fill out an application, and you could get a job. You could stop being homeless, you could make money, and you could stop living on the streets. Because you could do this in our minds, you believe that they can do this, then you could not be homeless. But we have no idea what is actually happening inside. We have no idea what they experienced before they got to the streets. We have no idea what drove them into the streets. Homeless by choice, it's a misnomer. Because, you know, everything's a choice. But what was their choice? Is it, do I live on the streets or do I stay home and be abused by my mother? Do I stay home and be sexually abused? Do I stay in a broken foster care system? It's a complicated situation. And the fact is, this is what's facing all these kids.
For your own interest, Vivian, in what led to the book, did you come back to the story later? Or is it the kind of thing you never were able to release your grasp on once you started covering it?
It was one of those stories that really just kind of sits with you. It's coming up in the Bay Area and being a journalist in the Bay Area, street kids were always a part of the fabric. Covering crime, it was always there. My very first story for the Chronicle actually had to do with street kids. It was interesting because it had nothing to do with street kids, but there was a murder in a park where street kids frequent, and automatically the first thought was that the murder had to do with street kids. And that's what happens, unfortunately, is whenever something bad happens, everyone kind of turns and looks at the homeless population. We kind of believe that they're capable of this. And that's the situation.
I want to point out, as you do very early in the book, that people shouldn't read the book thinking you have an answer for homelessness.
That was a very hard conclusion for me to come to, as any journalist can tell you. To go into a project and know that we don't have an answer, that's hard. But that's the problem. This is a complex situation. The reasons why these kids end up on the streets, I mean, the reasons are legion. It's, can we solve abusive parents? Can we solve abusive parenting? No. Can we solve a broken foster care system? Can we solve mental illness? Can we solve drug addiction? Can we solve all of that? It's an impossible task. That's not what I found I was able to do in the book, but I feel like what I was able to find was that I found that compassion. That was the answer that I found. And we could feel a little bit more compassion towards this subset, then I think that's a step in the right direction.
You got a bit of an education on your first day, as you point out, as an intern at the Chronicle in San Francisco. You went to a park and met Dave. Tell us about that that encounter.
Yes, I met Dave, and it was quite an experience. I grew up pretty sheltered, a pretty typical middle class upbringing, and I was told to prepare for a different kind of homelessness in the West Coast. I grew up on the East Coast, and so I came out here, and I totally bought into the whole concept of homeless by choice. And so when I came out and I met Dave, once again investigating that first story I spoke about earlier, the murder that had nothing to do with street kids, but everyone thought it had to do with street kids, I met Dave. And Dave totally fit the stereotype. He told me it was by choice. And that's also where it gets complicated, because a lot of these kids will tell you it's their choice, and you want to give them their agency, and you want to tell them, and you want to give them the space they need to figure out what they need. And that's where it gets very complicated, where it gets so difficult, where this whole issue is so complicated. Because the question is not, is it homelessness by choice? The question is, well, do you have the ability to not be homeless then? Because that was the question I should have asked Dave that day, but I didn't. I was a very new journalist, and I kicked myself every day thinking about it. But out came this kid. He told me he could make his own hours, he could wake up whenever he wanted, but here he was waking up at the crack of dawn so he could avoid the police. Here he was bearing the scars of street fights, and he had a torn earlobe, scars and cuts all over his face. He hadn't showered in days. He looked like he had been beat up recently. And I should have asked them, do you have the ability to leave this life if you wanted to? But I didn't. And I accepted his explanation that this is the choice that he wanted.
You talk about the street kids living, Vivian, in a kind of maturation limbo. Explain that.
That was another difficult thing about this, about my reporting, because when you say kid, you think, you know, 18. That's the legal age for us, right? 18. And it's easy to feel sympathy for a youth, for somebody under the age of 18, you know, because you think you're a kid, you don't know any better. But then, you know, when you get a young adult, you start thinking you should know better, you're a young adult. But when you are sent out on the street, when you're living on your own, when you don't have any guidance, when you never had an adult or anybody else to tell you what to do or guide you in the right direction, and nobody was able to teach you how to live and be responsible and function in society, you're stuck in a neverland. You're a kid forever. And so for a lot of the nonprofits that work with the homeless youth, a lot of the kids are actually 25 to 30. In the book, I define straight kids as up to the age of 30.
Okay, so that is, yeah, not kids by any stretch of the imagination, but the book is called Those Who Wander, America's Lost Street Kids. Author Vivian Ho is with us on the Jefferson Exchange. Let's bring in another name, Christian Garmiza Kalinske, who seemed to function as a kind of interpreter for you in a sense.
Oh, he was great, yeah. He was an eye-opener for me. He was actually one of the reasons why I felt so deeply that I had to tell the story. I met him at the first Haitian community meeting. And that was when I really saw it was extraordinary to see the hatred community turn around these street kids the way they did. It was the Haight-Ashbury. It was a community that made its name on these wandering souls, these vagabonds, these free spirits. And yet, when push came to shove, understandably, they felt a lot of fear and felt a lot of concern and were just saying some real awful things. And Christian really stood up for these kids because he was one of those kids. Once, not even a decade ago, he was sleeping out in the park and fighting for his life and fighting to survive. And he understood what it was like for this, but he understood how hard it was to leave that life.
And he points out that they generally flee one kind of trauma and end up living in a situation with other kinds of trauma.
And that's the situation. That's the worst thing about it. We talked about before about how it's homelessness by choice. And the choice is, well, do I stay home and get abused? Do I stay at home in this bad situation? Or do I live in the streets? For them, living on the streets is a wonderful freeing thing at first. It's wonderful. It's, at first, it's freedom. You don't get hit anymore. You don't have to deal with a parent or a guardian who treats you horribly. And you make your own rules, you do whatever you want. But then any second you spend outdoors, any second you spend on the streets, it's like throwing fuel on the fire through trauma. You're living to survive. You're stripped of your basic humanity because you're basically trying to live. You're living just to get by at this point. You're searching for food, you're searching for shelter, you're no longer trying to function as a human being. And think about the last time you got maybe 3 hours of sleep, 3 hours of bad sleep. Think about how awful you felt. These are these kids every night. They're sleeping on the ground, they're sleeping outside, they're sleeping cold, and then they have to worry about, you know, police coming and hassling them. They have to worry about shopkeepers complaining about them. They have to worry about moving. They have to worry about their things getting stolen. They have to worry about other street kids beating them up. They have to worry about getting raped. They have to worry about being assaulted. They have to be worried about everything.
So in talking with street kids, though, it seems like you found a kind of binary, Vivian, that they think about the other pathway, getting off the streets, but what do they think will happen if they opt for that pathway?
What I found with these street kids is that a lot of them still are just children. And they're, you know, even though they're young adults, they still have a very, very young and immature mindset. They think like you did at 15 or 14, that, you know, either you live free, you live this lifestyle, you live like a kid forever, or you're stuck as a zombie tied to a cubicle and you have to live as like a terrible working adult. And that's what it means to be an adult. nobody explained to them that there's a whole wide world out there. Nobody has ever explained to them all the options, that there's so much out there. And that's just so interesting, because they talk about how they're wanderers, how the world is their home, how everything is open to them. But really, the world is so narrow. Everything is just in front of them.
All right. Well, we're talking about the street kids with Vivian Ho, a journalist in San Francisco, was working for the San Francisco Chronicle when the murders of Audrey Carey and Steve Carter happened in San Francisco and Marin County in October 2015. It led to this book, Those Who Wander, America's Lost Street Kids, as she follows the results of the murder and the people who committed them, Hayes Lampley, Sean Angold, and Lila Scott Allgood. You can join us on The Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's talk about the murders and the people. Audrey Carey essentially didn't like where her road was heading in Quebec, and so did she essentially come to San Francisco to join Street Kids?
She wasn't joining Street Kids per se, but she was searching for her path in life. She had a bit of a wandering heart as well, and she was a free spirit, and she was like any other 23-year-old kid, she was trying to figure out her path in life. This was her first solo trip in San Francisco, and she was trying to figure it out. And right before she was killed, she had just written her mother that she was trying to figure out what she wanted to do. And unfortunately, her life was taken.
What had the killers been up to just before they met up with Audrey?
So Hayes Lampley and Lila Allgood were in a romantic relationship, and they had been for a few years. They had just been traveling and living in the streets for a long time and doing a lot of drugs. Sean Engold as well, he was also just living in the streets and doing a lot of drugs. And what happened was that Morris and Hayes Lampley had family land, so he believed. He had family land in Oregon, and he wanted to go there, and he wanted to lead a street life. He had this fantasy that he would take Lila up there, that they could set it out grow, and they could live off the land, that they never have to scrounge for money, scrounge for food, have to worry about fighting for survival again. So they were in San Diego at that time, and they started heading north. In San Francisco, they met up with Sean Angold, and as they were hanging around Golden Gate Park, that's when they ran into Audrey Carey. Audrey Carey was from Canada, and they got it because she was foreign, that maybe they could rob her, and she would have some money to help get them to Oregon. And unfortunately, the robbers weren't on a lie because they had gotten hold of the gun the night before. And the gun, they used the gun, and the gun led to Audrey Carey's death.
Now, the gun was in a car. They were just trying car handles up near Coit Tower, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. It was sort of a game that street kids play, where they kind of just try car handles and try to see what's unlocked, what is lost. And they found a car that was unlocked, and inside the car was a fully loaded gun with ammunition.
So that's what was used to kill Audrey. There's still some doubt about who really killed Audrey, because Sean turned on Hayes. Hayes said it was Sean. There's another wrinkle here, though, that gets interesting. The murder itself aside, Hayes criticized who Sean would steal from when he got in a drug-fueled binge. I mean, what was the? There seems like a code of ethics among street kids here.
There is a code of ethics among street kids, and you know that's what's a really fascinating thing. Like, inside their world, they have a very strict code of ethics. They do police their own. They kind of take care of their own their own bad actors. Like, a lot of, in Hate Street, they take care of the ones who are doing the hard drugs. They kick them out. If somebody is overtly too drunk, they try to get them out of the way so the neighbors don't complain. Because once one person starts acting badly, they know it reflects badly on the rest of them. In this situation, Sean Engel supposedly would rip off or rob other street kids. And Hayes Lampley took offense to this, and, you know, stealing from your own community.
All right, so that was the code of justice within the street kids. But the larger sense of justice, how did any of them seem affected by Audrey's murder?
That was a very jarring situation in that I got most of my accounts about their reactions from Hayes Lampley. And Hayes Lampley has a very flat effect. He just doesn't react to, he doesn't really process emotions, and he doesn't really talk about his emotions that much. He did not seem that moved by Audrey Carey's death. He did not seem particularly affected by it at all. He mentioned in passing that Sean Engle seemed affected by her death, that he was bugging out a little bit, that he seemed really panicked, that he seemed unhappy. In court, Sean Engle seemed a little upset, and when he talked about her death, he teared up a little bit, and he seemed pretty upset about it not happening. They had spent the afternoon with her. They talked with her. They got to know her. And you would think that because of that, that would be enough. But Hayes Lampley honestly doesn't remember anything about her.
Wow. So let's talk about Hayes a bit because you know, we've been talking sort of obliquely about the circumstances that lead people to be on the streets. You actually talked to Hayes' mother. What did she tell you of his upbringing?
So she talks about... she talked about how she would wander with Hayes, how they had a traveling lifestyle, like kind of a vagabond lifestyle. Like they would live in other bands. They would go follow Grateful Dead shows. They were never really truly homeless, but you know, it was a nomadic lifestyle that wasn't, she also, admitted to struggling with drug addiction during his childhood. She admitted that, there was a time when he was taken away from her, and he lived away from her, and she has no idea what happened to him during this time. And during this time, this is where it was hard for me to corroborate the facts, because his father's side of the family says everything he says is not true, and he tells me that he was sexually abused during this time, that he was physically abused, and that... He underwent enough trauma that he came back a different person. And his mother corroborated that he came back a different kid from what she remembered.
Right. Three years basically with his father as sole custody. And as you mentioned, it was hard to corroborate because the father wouldn't talk. You could talk to one grandparent and didn't use any of the names on that side of the family in the book. But what you were able to come up with was that there were mental illness diagnoses and meds. And apparently Hayes was self-medicating from apparently what age?
Very, very young. Very, very young. Probably from the age of 11. He was self-medicating from there, and he was using drugs, and hard drugs, heroin, and he was smoking pot, and he was drinking, and it's a hard situation. It's hard to tell, especially with sexual assault allegations. But from talking to Hayes and from my experience working with sexual assault victims, I believe that he was a victim of sexual abuse at some point. But whether or not it was at the hands of his father, I don't know. But I do believe that he was a victim of sexual abuse at some point in his life.
We were talking about Hayes being on the road with his mother from an early age, living in vans, going to Grateful Dead concerts, things like that, getting sent to live with his father at age 7, coming back close to 11, not in good shape, claiming sexual assault, on medications for mental illness diagnoses, shooting heroin by age 11. So of the many street kids you talk to, Vivian, is Hayes's case an extreme?
It was a very extreme case for sure. But the themes and the overall experiences that he had were not uncommon. I've heard from a lot of other street kids about similar situations of other kids who started drugs very early on, other kids who suffered from sexual abuse, other kids who suffered from sexual abuse at the hands of family members, other kids who suffered from physical abuse, mental illness, bad diagnoses, all of that.
So I want to get it. We haven't talked about the circumstances of the second murder of Steve Carter. He and his wife in Marin County has some active trauma of their own when the kids killed him. What was going on?
That was a heartbreaking case. That was, his wife, he and his wife moved to Marin County so that she could seek breast cancer treatment. They were a loving couple, and they were an outdoorsy couple, and they were there for the, that was supposed to be the hardest ordeal of their relationship, just fighting breast cancer. And then one day he goes to take a walk with his dog. He was going to bring her, but she was too tired. So he gives her a kiss, takes off for her hike, and meets up with the three.
Wow, and ended up dead as a result. And the circumstances still rather unclear on who pulled trigger, who did what in that murder, too?
So in this situation, it was 2 days after Audrey Carey's murder. They realized it was taking too long for them to get to Oregon, and so they needed a car. They picked Steve Carter because they needed a car. And in this case, Lila Allegood actively chose Steve Carter because he had white hair. They thought that he was older and that they could take him. All of them maintained that they all just wanted to rob both Audrey Carey and Steve Carter. That's all that they always maintained, that they wanted to rob them. But where it gets dicey, and where I talk about pretty clearly in the book, is that Hayes, who I get most of my details from, has a very strange relationship with the truth. It changes often for him, and what he says does not always match up with what other people say, what investigators say, what his co-defendants said. And in this situation, he told me something that was just so preposterous that it was astounding. He told me that it was purely an accident, that he did not mean to shoot Steve Carter. He told me he tripped and he pulled the trigger. But what happened, according to investigators, was that the clip was emptied. So it was a semi-automatic gun. He had to have pulled the trigger multiple times. Steve Carter was hit multiple times. His dog was hit. So for that to have happened would have been preposterous. But he maintains that was what happened. And then he would go back, and I would ask him. I'm like, so you weren't gonna rob? You were just gonna rob him. You weren't gonna shoot him. And he would say that he would do whatever needed to be done to get the car. And I would ask him what that meant. And he would say just whatever it needed to be done.
Huh. So they ended up getting Steve Carter's car, and that was the one they actually took to Portland, where they got arrested. And how long after that were they arrested?
It was just a few days. Steve Carter's car had a GPS, and they were able to be, investigators were able to track them to a soup kitchen in Portland, Oregon.
So at some point you decided this is a story where I need to talk to more street kids. So where did you go? I mean, how did you find people to talk to, and did many of them refuse to talk to you?
So I went to a lot of the places where Hayes Lansley went. You know, I went to San Diego, where he grew up. I went to San Francisco, where he says he has a special connection. I went to Portland, and I spoke to a lot of kids in those hubs. And then I also just poked around and kept talking to other kids all over. I found a group of kids who frequented a situation called the Rainbow Gathering, which is not specifically for street kids, but attracts a lot of street kids. And through that, I was able to go to a regional Rainbow Gathering where I met a lot of other street kids. And that was in Arizona.
Okay. We had talked about the things that come from childhood trauma from the people here. And of course, you spent most of the Hayes was the person who opened up the most to you. We've talked about the parenting. His mom is Mindy. You talked to her too. He defends her parenting, but let's talk about the things that she had growing up, because it sounds like her own adolescence was quite bumpy.
Yeah. Yeah, she had a pretty awful childhood as well. And she defends her parents as well. She was pregnant at the age of 13. She was addicted to drugs at the age of 13. Her entire life, all she knew was that if she wanted to feel better, she could, there was drugs and alcohol. That was the only reality that she knew. The only time that she was clean, she says, was when she was pregnant with Hayes and his younger brother. But she has since gone off past that life. She's been sober now for almost 5 years.
All right, so she's kept on the straight and narrow. But here again, we're talking about the fact that the kinds of things that led to him having a horrible existence were basically replicated in his mom's upbringing as well. Come back and talk about Christian Kalinske again, San Francisco, who helps street kids, or did. What in his own experience led him to help street kids?
For a lot of these kids, they just have to have that moment, that one moment when they realize that this is not the life I want to live anymore. And it's hard because, that you can hit rock bottom, and then when even your rock bottom has a rock bottom, and you can keep hitting it and hitting it, hitting it. And your rock bottom can sink down so low. For him, he met it in jail, and he got a cold cup of coffee. And he remember thinking, oh God, my life is good. And he just had this awful realization. And he's like, is this as good as it's going to get? Just being happy about a cold cup of coffee in jail. And he thought, I don't want this life anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. And he was also strung out on drugs. He was addicted to drugs. He was doing drugs to kill himself, basically. And he just wouldn't die. And since then, he's also turned his life around. He has a beautiful family. He used to run a nonprofit helping kids. And the nonprofit had to shine for money purposes. But he's living a great life now.
So Christian was one of several people who pointed out that most street kids won't do the kinds of things, commit two murders that Hayes, Lila, and Sean did. So what does he think got them to cross a line?
I think it's most street kids won't do it. I agree with that. Most street kids won't do it. But it's one of those situations where you are at your lowest of your lows. When you're fighting for survival, when you're at your survival instinct situation, think about it. Like when you're just fighting for food, fighting for shelter, fighting for water, fighting for clothing, when you're just thinking about that every day, you stop thinking about morals. You stop thinking about, emotions. You stop thinking about the well-being of other people. You start thinking it's okay to steal. You start thinking, okay, you make it okay to do what you take one step in one direction. It's okay for me to take this from this person. And then you take another step forward. It's okay for me to take this from this person at gunpoint. And then you just keep taking one step further, one step further, one step further until it's too late to turn back around.
What does Christian observe about society's efforts to get street kids into homes, or at least to make people vanish from the streets?
We both noticed this. There's a certain disdain for this population, for street kids especially. Especially street kids, I feel like, because there's a certain disdain for them because we see them and we see them as able-bodied. And we think, you could get a job. You could not be homeless if you wanted to. So why are you homeless? So this is obviously your choice. You're doing this. Why can't you get off the streets? And so we blame them for the life that they had. We blame them for having trauma. We blame them for suffering. And we hate them for existing. And because of that, we just don't help them. We don't look to them. We don't think about them.
I'm struck by the story you relay of a woman who owns a business in the Hate. She came out for the Summer of Love and stayed, but has no patience for people who come out now.
Yeah, that was hard. That was hard. And talking to her, I mean, she's such a sweet woman. And I still think of her as a really good person. But it's just, I mean, like, how do you not see these people as human beings? And that's what I really hope to achieve with this book. I just want people to feel more compassion. And that's the hardest thing about this. For a lot of these kids, they're not asking for much. They're asking for people to look them in the eye and see them as human beings. Because so many people, like, they just look right over them. They won't even look at them. They won't even glance at them. They just treat them as less than. And these people, they're kids. They're real, actual human beings. And they're real human beings who are hurting. And they need our compassion more than anybody else.
Where it gets into trouble with the public, though, is where it ends up getting with people all over the streets, as they seem to be in San Francisco. And that seems to be in the news all the time now, that people left and right complain about the fact that San Francisco seems to be overrun with homeless people, defecation on the sidewalk, etc. Are there programs anywhere that you observed that seem to make a difference, that seem to make a dent in homelessness, particularly with the street kid subset that you focused on?
I thought the Christian's program was a really good program. It was fantastic. His program would offer a volunteer service, basically. And so it would get the kids housing, but then it would have them, in exchange for housing, they had to volunteer and clean up Haight Street for a certain amount of hours. And it was perfect because it would teach them responsibility in a way that nobody's ever taught them responsibility. They had to show up. They had to do a duty, they have to fulfill their job requirements. And then from there, they could help them. Like he would be like, do you want to go back to school? Do you want to get a job? And then he would help them figure out what they wanted to do. And so much of it too, it's just housing. Like you just need housing. I mean, it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You just need, like, it's just having shelter and having a safe place to not feel scared all the time. Like that's so vital. And unfortunately, we don't have enough of that. We have no place to go for that.
Vivian, we got about 30 seconds left. We've been talking about a number of programs that get into the trauma-informed care, where you acknowledge when you're dealing with children that they have problems in their background. You need to be able to use basically soft hands with them. Have you got to examine any programs like that?
I have. There are a lot of programs that do offer counseling, that do offer just patience. Mm-hmm. That's all it is, just patience with these kids. Like that's all they require. And that's hard because, you know, you have so many numbers and so many kids and so many people you need to help. But what these kids really need is just time. And they need a place to feel safe. Some of these kids, they just need a place to sit down for an hour a day and exist as human beings.
All right, we do learn a lot in the book. It is called Those Who Wander, America's Lost Street Kids. Vivian Ho, the author and our guest. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
All right, take care.